Hello, I'm Douglas Frank. I'm here with Mitra Mark Power to have a conversation. So Mitra Mark, it is wonderful to see you and thank you for joining me in this conversation.
Thank you, Douglas.
So how did you come to the Buddha Dharma?
You want the burnished or unvarnished?
which is ever your favorite to tell?
Well, what stands out in my memory is that I was about 17, 18, and I was really desperate. Deep into my rebellion and I was having trouble making sense of the options that seemed to be available to me in my life, education and just having trouble envisioning a future. And I began exploring the various philosophies and encountered first, I think it was Walden, Henry David Thoreau, and it was somewhat by serendipity that in the town that I lived in didn't have a very big bookstore, and when I went to purchase related books, there were only a few more on the shelf before you got into the Buddhist stuff, because transcendentalism and then Eastern religions. And I found books by Suzuki Roshi and by Trungpa Rinpoche. Mm-hmm. And that's really how I met the Dharma. And then I began to explore the experience of both of those teachers, or I should say, Suzuki Roshi, I experienced through the Zen Center in San Francisco. He had already died. And then it was about 6 months of exploring the Zen practice. And then I really connected wholeheartedly with Trungpa Rinpoche and what was then the Vajradhatu world.
And what year would this have been approximately?
1977.
Okay. So the beginning was Zen moving towards being with Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. And when did you connect with him?
1977. well, actually, about a year before. It's a funny story. I was hitchhiking cross country, and I was obviously very young, also very naive. And
now, how old are you at this point?
26. I was about 18.
Okay, all right. Please continue.
And I lived in New Hampshire, so I was hitchhiking to Los Angeles, and I was going to go via the northern route. So I went up through Vermont, which was still so I went to Tale of the Tiger. It hadn't become Kermit Chilling yet. And there happened to be a seminar going on. I was pretty much a hick from New Hampshire. I had this, you know, dilettantish interest in Eastern religion, but really no experience. I was headed out to the Zen Center. And so I camped in the field at Tale of the Tiger, and in the morning awoke to find there was a big tent there. And I was told that Trungpa Rinpoche was going to be teaching and I could stay for the day. And so I was waiting in the tent with everybody else for Trungpa Rinpoche to arrive. And I remember this Volkswagen bus pulling up next to the tent, and this commotion outside the tent, and all of these people kind of trying to usher somebody in. And I looked over and I saw what I initially thought was a drunk Mexican fellow. Again, that's where I was from. And I had no idea. And then this fellow sat on the dais and began teaching. And indeed, he was intoxicated, but he was really brilliant. And I don't remember the words so much as the ambiance and the energetic connection that I made with him at that time.
So what followed that?
Well, I went to the Zen Center, and that was my first real experience of Buddhist practice. And I realized that, you know, the stories of enlightenment, and you know, I had a kind of timeline in mind. You know, well, Shakyamuni Buddha did it in X number of years, so I guess that's what I can expect. And I got to the Zen Center and began practicing in accordance with the Zen discipline. And didn't take long for me to realize, oh, this is really hard work. Everything about it hurts. You know, my knees hurt, my mind hurts, everything was painful. I only lasted for about 6 months, and then I continued my search and ended up in Los Angeles, where I connected with the Dharmadhatu there. And it was the early days of the LA Dharmadhatu, and it was really a wonderful place. A lot of creative energy, a lot of artists. And Trungpa Rinpoche and his regent used to come through at least once a year. So that's how I began studying with them in earnest.
Okay. And when did you connect with the Vajra regent?
Same time. He had been installed as the regent in 1976. And then the first time I saw him was in a seminar in Los Angeles in 1977.
Okay.
In the summer of 77.
So you continued to study with Trungpa Rinpoche and the Vajra regent, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
And then what followed the death of Trungpa Rinpoche in terms of your Dharma path?
Yeah, well, prior to that, in 1983, the Vajra regent invited me to be on his staff to kind of lead his household and to be one of his main attendants. And so I moved from Los Angeles to Boulder in 1983 with Marion, who we weren't married at the time, but got married in Boulder. And then I began to work full-time for the Vajra regent, including the move to Nova Scotia, to Halifax, in 1985. And it was then 2 years into our time in Halifax when Trungpa Rinpoche passed into Parinirvana. And then it was only a year later where the Vajra regent was diagnosed with AIDS and moved to Ojai, California, and we followed. And then he died in 1990.
That was all a very painful period of time. I was a member of Vajradhatu, and when I think about that period of time, it's just a lot of, for me, a lot of sadness.
Yes.
Around that.
Me too. A lot of relationships were fractured. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of anger, a lot of feeling of betrayal, mm-hmm. a lot of hurt that has, I think, never really been healed. Yeah.
Aina and I continue to sort of process that period of time.
Yes.
These many years later.
Me too.
So how did you, we're just moving along your Dharma path here. This is your life. The television show from probably before your time, actually.
No, I remember that. Yeah. Yeah,
this is your life. You could bring people in, you know. So how did you come to meet Dzogchen Punlop Rinpoche?
Well, the first time was in 1980 when His Holiness the 16th Karmapa came to the U.S. and he traveled through Los Angeles. And Punlop Rinpoche was one of his attendants. He had a large entourage. So I remember mostly Punlop Rinpoche's father, because I was one of the kasung and a driver. And I drove Punlop Rinpoche's father. Mm. Who was a notable character because he was dressed in traditional Kampa dress. So he had his chuba and he wore, I think, cowboy boots and looked very much the cowboy part. He had long braided hair and he gave off an air of, don't mess with me. He wasn't unfriendly mm-hmm. at all, but there was something very solid about him. And I met Punlop Rinpoche just tangentially there because he was always very close, in close proximity to His Holiness. Mm-hmm. And what I could observe of Punlop Rinpoche at the time was that he was... was very energetic. He was a trickster. Really enjoyed practical jokes. His Eminence Jam Kongtrul Rinpoche was also in His Holiness's entourage, and he and Punlop Rinpoche were very close. Mm-hmm. That was my first meeting, and then I think it was 13 years later. After Rinpoche had graduated the Shedra and perhaps had even moved to New York by then, but he was doing a teaching tour out around the country. And I met him again in Southern California. And at that time, it was 1993, I was longing for some connection. And it was a pretty organic, natural connection there. He seemed to have a lot of the qualities of Trungpa Rinpoche, an inscrutability, a playfulness, and a willingness to really engage the Western culture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you began studying with Punlop Rinpoche, and it sounds like mid 90s or so.
Yeah.
And at what, what's that?
I think it was the early 90s because he was then beginning the Treasury of Knowledge retreats in and around San Antonio, Texas.
Okay.
It was after His Eminence Jung Kongtrul had died.
Mm-hmm.
And Punlop Rinpoche picked up the mantle for leading the mm-hmm. Treasury of Knowledge retreats. And I remember going to those early retreats and really connecting in those settings because there was such intimacy and a deep exploration of the Dharma.
Aina and I have gone to a number of the TOK retreats and the intimacy is, it's just lovely. It's just lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you become a Mitra. Could you talk a little bit about how that came about and what a Mitra means to you?
Well, it was an appointment by Rinpoche to five of us at the time, and four of us who continue. And the way that I think of it is, when you're first waging a battle, you send in the infantry. And you realize that only a certain number of those are going to survive, and you have to do it because you've got to learn the culture. You've got to learn the battlefield, so to speak. This is strictly a personal interpretation. Okay.
is there anything helpful
for this? Yeah. But certainly when I became a Mitra, and I will only speak for myself, it felt like clothes that didn't fit. And there was a real sense of Rinpoche putting a lot of responsibility on the Mitras and making it clear that we were in some way holding his lineage. And I say in some way because he never really spelled it out for us. And sometimes we would hear from other people, oh, Rinpoche said this about the Mitras, and that would help us to understand what our role included. Mm-hmm. But over time, I think that what it means to me, that battle analogy still fits. You know, there's a you're never particularly comfortable. You have responsibility. It's not always clear, and you're left to make some decisions on your own that really you would rather have a lineage direction for. So it's a powerful ground of uncertainty for me, and yet I find that there are times when I can take my seat within it, and there are times when I really would rather just run away from it.
It sounds like on-the-job training without a good job description, a real clear job description in some sense.
Or maybe no job description.
So what would you say if you would be willing to attempt, what is the major learning that you have gotten out of your role as a Mitra?
I think that being a teacher is more than anything a responsibility, that it doesn't necessarily rest on your merits as a scholar or even strictly speaking as a practitioner. It's not something you can have or own. It's something that you are yoked to. If you want it, you haven't felt the full weight of it yet. And so I think the ongoing lesson that I am learning is one of letting go, and I can't really be more specific than that because it's very fluid. it is a kind of moment by moment experience.
The older I get, the more I realize that letting go is the key.
Yeah, I agree.
When I don't, just count on pain. Yeah. So poetry has been a part of your life. I'm not sure how big a part, but I know that when you come to Boulder, you love to bring poetry into your teaching. And I love just to hear you speak to that.
Poetry for me is a lifeline. I'm not a well-trained or educated poet in the sense of being able to speak to styles and meter and so forth. I really like lyric poetry that speaks in ordinary language, but is full of surprise. And I think that what I like so much about poetry is its ability to reveal a surprise in the moment, to be going down what appears to be a certain pathway that are formed by the words that the poet has chosen. And then you turn a corner and there's this wide open, vibrant space, or another surprising emotional texture. And that's a moment of awakening for me. Sometimes I rely on poetry as a way of gaining some nurture if I feel depressed, for the same reason that it will allow you to follow a certain logic up to a point, and then it flips, and it's that flip, that openness, that surprise that takes takes one to the present moment. Mm-hmm. And that's what I like so much about poetry. Yeah.
Are there some poets that you tend to hang out with on some kind of regular basis?
Yes. Well, you know, Mary Oliver, sometimes people put her off to the side because she's so beloved, but she's beloved for a reason, and that is she's her mastery of bringing the natural world alive. So Mary Oliver is a favorite. Ted Kooser is someone that I go back to again and again, and he is one that talk about surprise, and he has his book, Delights and Shadows. He speaks of the most ordinary things, and then it'll become a fireworks display or a bouquet of you know, spring flowers or something. It just take on tremendous vividness in the most ordinary way. Naomi Shihab Nye, Philip Larkin, Ellen Bass. I love Ellen Bass. Marie Howe. Jeez, there's so many. Yeah.
Oh, lovely. Yeah, the expression on your face as you're describing this is just delightful. It's just kind of like open and
yeah. It is it's extraordinary to me the gifts that poetry can bring to the world. It's funny too, because many of us, at least of our generation, may have been exposed to poetry that was da 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 da. And so when I do workshops and I say I'm going to read a poem, I always pay close attention to the subtle body language that I see in the audience, because there is often, oh God, I remember that, you know, that fifth grade or sixth grade memorization.
Right.
But then it's great fun to see that same kind of softening you just mentioned, that, mm-hmm. oh, look at that surprise, yeah. that look what that poet just revealed.
Mm-hmm. For me, there's some of the best quote unquote sort of Dharma teachers,
yeah.
around, the good ones, that, like you're saying, they for me, they kind of like open the world in a new way. And it's just a simple, a geese flying overhead, and it just,
the magic,
I think the magic of the world is what, for me, is what poetry captures.
By not saying it all,
right,
you know, it, by leaving these big gaps, by jumping from a particular stream of language over to another, you know, jumping from rock to rock, so to speak,
right,
and then falling in the water, or yeah, I agree.
Yeah, do you write poetry?
Sometimes, mm-hmm. sometimes, mm-hmm. I tend to be a bit intimidated, because I'm a perfectionist. That is one of the pitfalls. It's one of the ditches that I fall into, perfectionism. Mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. so I hold the bar pretty high.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, rely on those that I know clear the bar.
There's a part of
right sometimes.
Oh, nice! That's beautiful. I, as a, with a father of a daughter who's an artist, I think that, and I think this applies to a lot of the arts, that to a certain extent, people are born like poets in some sense, that it's just like their first language in some kind of sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm growing more content with being the one who can appreciate, rather than being the one who has to create.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's where I'm at with almost all art.
Although I have seen some of your art, and I am a great fan.
Oh, well, that is very sweet. Thank you. So one of the activities that you are intimately involved with through Nalanda Bodhi is the Path of Mindful Activity. And I would love to just touch on it here and then look at having a second conversation to focus more on that, if that is okay with
you. Sure. Path of Mindful Activity is traditionally one of the three wheels of Dharma that were taught by the Buddha, in the sense of the wheels of study, meditation and activity, sometimes translated as work. But it's the integration of our insights and our experience gained through study and meditation with our day-to-day lives and activities. And What I've learned about this in our various Dharma communities is that It's easy to assume because we're learned or because we meditate well, that we are carrying that into our lives. And I think certainly to some degree that's true. An impression is made and it resonates. However, without a clear and deliberate intention, it doesn't really transform our lives. And it's the everyday life that we live, well, that occupies the most of our time, where we spend hours at work and hours in relationship and et cetera, you know. And so it's such a broad, a vast field of practice. And in Nalanda Bodhi, we've been working steadily to try and make that a rich field of training, so that there are ways that feel relevant, the ways that we can really merge the benefits of study and practice with our lived lives. But one of the tricks about the path of mindful activity is that you really can't prescribe it. It has to be personal. It has to be something that we take hold of individually and then apply that in a very moment-to-moment sense. Mm-hmm. But there are, I think this is a wonderful place for learning from Sangha, learning from each other, mm-hmm. hearing how do you bring this into your life? Ah, that's an interesting idea. Mm-hmm. And it gives us all permission to be imperfect, mm-hmm. because we do it in clumsy ways sometimes. And some of us do it in very elegant beautiful ways, but there's no single way. So it's a challenge to present it. Mm-hmm. And that's what we work with, our core team, Path of Mindful Activity.
Mm-hmm. I would love to pick this conversation up another time to explore this in more depth, if that is possible.
We will only know by trying.
And then we will see the result.
And fortunately, this is a recording, so only you and I have to know.
Well, exactly. And it could be disappeared like that. Yeah. It's that possibility of impermanence right here, right now.
Yeah, that would be great. You know, sometimes, maybe this is true for all of us, but sometimes I learn more about whether it's poetry or Path of Mindful Activity. When I hear myself responding to questions, I realize, oh, that's what I think.
Right.
That's what I think it is. Okay.
I find that to be true, that you know, someone will ask me something and I'll respond and I'll think, wow, who are you?
Yeah.
Where'd that come from? Evidently was there, just never really had it come out before.
Yeah.
So we'll plan on a second one and we'll see what comes out.
Okay, great.
Thanks, Is Douglas. There a slogan or a Dharma teaching that acts as your North Star?
The thing that is the most persistent is a deeper and more honest exploration of kindness. I don't have a specific slogan, but the texture of it is letting be, you know. It's kind of going against the tendencies to be ambitious or to be embarrassed or, you know, to feel less than, all of which are part of my vocabulary on, you know, some energetic level. And I think that the depths of kindness, when I really give into that as an embodied experience and not as an idea, that's where it feels like I'm really treading on the path, and where I'm not turning my back on important aspects of what needs to be addressed, or what needs to be met. I mean, addressed is not a good word. What needs to be met, what needs to be seen.
So that is kind of the to use like the Vajra image, kind of like Vajra kindness, not just mushy kindness, but actually meeting with intelligence in that.
Yeah, I wouldn't, you know, that word may work for you. It doesn't for me, but I get your intention there. And I think that's, yes, just to give you an example, sometimes when I hear or I even think to myself, you know, this is an opportunity for kindness, that's very superficial. Mm-hmm. And it kind of covers a base of I don't know, be nice. It's kind of like be nice. Mm-hmm. But the deeper sense of kindness, the deeper experience of kindness is actually a kind of surrender. It's being fully present to something without putting up a condition. That's how I think of it in this moment. Mm-hmm. So I guess you're right. It is, there's a Vajra quality to it. Don't settle for that sticky kindness. I don't know. It's a hard one because, you know, there's a tendency to want to distance myself from that stickiness also. It's like, oh no, I'm not that kind. I'm not that kind of kind. But I am. I can be sentimental and sticky. But it's the deeper, I guess it's the deeper exploration of that feels more alive on my path. I have no idea if any of that makes sense.
It does, because coming out of the life that I came out of, very religious, strict religious, fearful religious kind of situation, kindness is a major bumper sticker for me for myself and for others, because I've known harshness.
Yes.
And how to embody real kindness, what that actually means.
It's I remember when I was in training as a chaplain, It was during that time that I recognized that so much of my impetus for being on the Buddhist path was an effort, an attempt to get away from myself, to transcend myself, rather than to meet and transform myself. And it was in that time period that I really recognized how harsh I was being to myself under the guise of Dharma.
Right.
And that was a real awakening for me, and has been a constant part of my path ever since. When I find myself becoming stiff or righteous or, you know, whatever constricted version of myself I can become, I know that what's happening there is a harshness that I need to find my way back to a genuinely kind expression to unravel.
What I've always gotten in the workshops that you have offered here in Boulder, it seems to me that one of the focuses that you bring out is our humanness and how the path is actually to open into our full humanness and the good, the bad, and the ugly. And so that's one of the things that I appreciate your teaching, because I can be, this is how the Dharma is, and you've like all of the messy parts of being a human being, you kind of want to get rid of them.
Yeah. It's tempting. It would be really tempting if it was possible.
Yeah, I think that's the key. You don't hear any teachers saying that.
Well, I just haven't found it to be very effective to go that way. You know, I think we're still doing the work. Well, we will be for quite a while, translating the Vajrayana Dharma into the West. I think there are a lot of meeting points that still have to be negotiated. Might not be the best word, but there has to be a conversation. And until that conversation happens, I think that there are some blockages to really fully transplanting the traditions. Mm-hmm. But that's a longer conversation, and one which I'm not particularly, I have no expertise, but again, it's our individual experience on the path that how are we transplanting this Dharma in our own lives?
Mm-hmm. Is there any, during this period of talking during this period of COVID right now, I'm curious how practice is helping you to navigate this particular period.
Short sessions for me. Really allowing my mind to settle simply. A little bit of the Vipassana inquiry, just naturally, not according to prescription. And then the most intentional aspect of my practice is the shamatha and kindness, whether it's through a form of tonglen or simply more self-directed loving kindness. Exploring to find what's natural, what's genuine. Those are the things that I find help me take the next step.
Well, I want to thank you for having this conversation with me. Before, is there anything else that you would like to add before we finish?
Not unless I can read a poem.
Oh, please do.
There's one that I was reading. It's a favorite, but I was reading it again last night. It's a Ted Kooser poem. And it's called At the Cancer Clinic. She's being helped toward the open door that leads to the examining rooms by two young women I take to be her sisters. Each bends to the weight of an arm and steps with a straight, tough bearing of courage. At what must seem to be a great distance, a nurse holds the door, smiling and calling encouragement. How patient she is in the crisp white sails of her clothes. The sick woman peers from under her funny knit cap to watch each foot swing, scuffing forward, and take its turn under her weight. There is no restlessness or impatience or anger anywhere in sight. Grace fills the clean mold of this moment, and all the shuffling magazines grow still. At the Cancer Clinic by Ted Kooser.
Ted Kooser. I love his poetry. Yeah. I think he's from Nebraska.
He's from Nebraska.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful photograph that I saw of his shop. It's a little, looks like a one-story brick building, big picture window out front with the lettering on it, poetry fixed and made here. It looks like an old TV repair shop.
A buddy who turned me on to him actually went to his town to see that. So I think that the next time you are in Colorado, we should have a little pilgrimage to go see this shop.
Oh, I'm in. I'm in.
Yeah, for him, it was like a pilgrimage. Yes, it was.
Yeah.
So thank you for joining me in this conversation. And I would like to do volume two of more focused on exploring the path of mindful activity. So thank you.
Thank you, Douglas. Always a delight to talk with you. And I hope that you will allow your alter ego, Mr. Ikebana, some opportunity for expression in the not too distant future. The world needs his wisdom.
As they say, that stops my mind. Thank you for that. You have a good day, and
you the same.
Blessings to you and your family.
Thank you very much.